From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In Des Moines tonight, six Democrats will take the stage in the last presidential candidates debate before the first 2020 vote in Iowa, which is now just 20 days away. Polls showing the caucus wide open. The top four contenders, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Pete Buttigieg, will all be on stage tonight, as will Amy Klobuchar and Tom Steyer. Domenico Montanaro, NPR senior political editor and correspondent, is here. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Robin.
So in last month's debate, Buttigieg became the target and survived. Now Warren and Sanders, who've been in something of a like-minded ceasefire, an agreement, you know, not to attack each other, are trading barbs. Let me just try to lay this out. You tell me if I've got it. The Sanders campaign told volunteers to label Warren as a candidate of the elite, but Bernie Sanders says he didn't approve that. Then last night, Warren accused Sanders of telling her privately that he didn't think a woman could win the presidency. Now, in a statement, Sanders said that's ludicrous. He said the aides, presumably Warren's, who were not in the room, are lying. Sanders said he said that Trump was a sexist liar who would weaponize the fact that she was a woman. And then he said, of course, I think she can win. Hillary won by 3 million votes. So how big a deal do you think this is going to be on the stage tonight?
Well, you certainly have a disagreement there between the two principals of the campaigns. This is not just volunteers going around making these accusations. They've risen to the level of the candidates. And if you read between the lines, there's clearly some overlap there between what Warren said in her statement that Bernie Sanders told her a woman couldn't win in their meeting in 2018, and what Bernie Sanders is saying there in that Donald Trump would weaponize the fact that he'd be running against a woman. So that is going to be a flashpoint. Sanders is going to have to walk a very delicate line in explaining it. Warren is also going to have to, you know, kind of make a case for whoever leaked that information, whether or not how she comes across. So look, the optics of it are going to be really interesting lines for both of them to walk. And you're right, they have for months had this kind of detente where they were just not going to attack each other because they see each other as allies in a progressive movement, but they know that there is a big Venn diagram of voters. And if you're going door knocking and someone says to you, you know, I'm on Elizabeth Warren's team and you're a volunteer for Bernie Sanders, you have to make some case to say why that person should abandon Elizabeth Warren, and that's certainly going to ruffle some feathers.
Well, but did maybe Warren's campaign also misstep here? Because you can Google Bernie Sanders saying a woman absolutely can be president. He's been saying it for decades.
Well, you know, sure, but that's a little different than what happened in 2016, kind of as Warren puts it, as punditry, right, where there's been this debate over the last couple of years since the 2016 election on whether a woman could win, even though Hillary Clinton won 3 million more votes, as Sanders points out, in that there are some who believe that it made it more difficult to win in the states that Donald Trump had won. Now, I'm, you know, certainly not making a case one way or the other for whether that's true or not. I don't think you can quantify it exactly. I know the Clinton campaign certainly thought that there was some sexism involved, and we've heard from Democratic voters who were a little skittish early on to vote for a woman. But Elizabeth Warren seemed to win them over and prove that she could win by the fall when she started surging in the polls. And I think that's where we're at, where I had a Sanders person close to Sanders earlier in the year tell me that they're not going to attack Warren unless they get down to nearly the final two. And that's where we are with the two of them in the top four.
Yeah. Amy Klobuchar, by the way, is probably also going to have something to say about how a woman can be president.
As the other woman on stage, right. She'll point out.
Right. But a lot else might be going on tonight. Sanders has stepped up his criticism of Joe Biden for his vote in the Iraq war, his vote to go to war, at a time now when Democrats want to take the lead in criticizing President Trump's targeting of an Iranian general for reasons that are not quite yet clear. You've got Tom Steyer on the stage and some people saying, wow, how did he last to be of the six? Cory Booker dropped out. People are wondering where his voters will go. What will you be looking for tonight?
Well, certainly, you know, that Warren Sanders dynamic is going to be interesting, but who does that benefit? You know, Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg potentially could benefit from that. And you could see Buttigieg chime in and talk about the fact that Warren has been hitting him on backing away from big ideas when she's backed away from a pretty big idea in Medicare for All. So you could wind up seeing something of a triangular or quadrangular firing squad here with the top four candidates. And then Klobuchar being able to sort of try to chime in as well and try to be a voice of reason is what I would expect. She has a lot on the line. You know, she's from a neighboring state in Minnesota, and she needs to really have a very strong showing in Iowa to probably pierce one of those top four in order to be able to continue her candidacy.
We have to mention you also have a Trump rally in Milwaukee tonight as the next phase of impeachment unfolds. Nancy Pelosi telling House members she's going to deliver those two articles of impeachment tomorrow, so the trial might start soon. But we also have this confusion about Iran. I just want to ask you about Defense Secretary Mark Esper's interview with NPR yesterday. At first, he said the U.S. doesn't have legal authority to strike in Iran because of actions of Iranian-backed militias in Iraq, because of the 2002 Congressional Authorization of Military Force. And then Ari Shapiro and the NPR crew were chased down the hall by an aide who said, come back, come back. And they were asked to re-interview Esper, who reversed his answer. He said, yes, the U.S. does have the authority to strike in Iran under Article 2 of the Constitution. Let's listen.
If it is consistent with the Commander-in-Chief's authorities under Article 2 to defend the nation, our people, and our interests, yes, we do.
Your thoughts on that, Domenico?
They're very tenuous authorizations. I mean, the AUMF was not intended for strikes that lasted, you know, for almost two decades later. Article 2 is also fairly vague. It's about, you know, imminent threats and defending the security of the country. And that's why we have heard these sort of evolving or conflicting stories over the last several days on what the reasoning and rationale was for taking out General Soleimani. So, you know, I think some of the Democratic candidates on stage are going to be asking why haven't the American people, in their words, gotten a straight story?
And why do you have to send an aide running down the hall to redo an interview for such an important question?
Well, they wanted to clarify and make sure that he was expressing exactly what he wanted to express and not get himself in trouble with the president.
There you go. Domenico Montanaro, NPR senior political editor and correspondent. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Cuban Americans are divided over new restrictions on travel to Cuba announced by the Trump administration. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo asked federal transportation officials to suspend charter flights to all Cuban cities except Havana. The move follows an earlier order that halted regular U.S. flights to Cuba's provincial cities. As NPR's Greg Allen reports, some Cuban Americans see the rule as part of the president's re-election campaign.
At Miami International Airport, the people waiting in line for flights to Cuba are easy to spot. They usually check multiple bags, large screen TVs, even, as I saw, a set of car tires. Since October, when the Trump administration canceled regular airline service to Cuba's outlying cities, the only way for visitors to fly to Cuban airports outside of Havana was on a charter flight. In his announcement, Secretary of State Pompeo said in 60 days, all U.S. charter flights to nine provincial cities would also end. At the airport, William Morales was waiting in line for a flight to Santa Clara with six big overstuffed bags.
Just take a lot of stuff to my family because since the restrictions are going on, then it's so harder to not go to Havana. All the way from Havana to Santa Clara is going to take 4 hours together, so it's much harder than it would be before Trump did this.
Pompeo says ending the flights will limit the economic benefit the Cuban government gets from U.S. visitors. But Morales says the first to feel the pinch will be Cubans who rely on aid from family in the States.
It makes sense to restrict the government's activities and to probably end communism over there, but at the same time you're hurting the families of people who live here.
Other Cuban Americans, though, especially those whose families came here in the 60s and 70s, support the restrictions and any move to make travel to Cuba more difficult. Carlos Ayer teaches religious studies at Yale. He fled Cuba as an 11-year-old in the early 60s. He's critical of Cuban Americans who travel to the island sometimes several times a year, spending money that he believes ultimately helps keep the regime in power.
They don't care if it's permanent. They don't care to change anything. And it's not going to change if they keep going back and forth and pouring billions into the economy.
Pompeo says the administration now wants to limit the number of charters that fly into Havana. Vivian Manaroot has been dealing with the ups and downs of U.S. and Cuba travel restrictions since the 1980s, when she organized her first charter flights to the island. As for why these are being imposed now, Manaroot believes there's a simple answer: politics.
The community is completely divided over this issue. There is no humanitarian reason. There is no sanction reason. It is all done for 2020 elections. No other reason.
Guillermo Grenier, a sociology professor at Florida International University, says the Cuban Americans most affected by the new restrictions are those who arrived in the U.S. in the last 20 years, and they're also the least likely to vote.
Exhibiting a hard line towards Cuba is a known entity. I mean, if you do that, you drink cafecito, and then you say, you know, we're going to overturn the Cuban government, you can probably calculate that's going to get you 100,000 votes.
As for Cuban Americans with family on the island, once U.S. flights to outlying cities are no longer possible, travel professionals expect many will begin doing what they had to do in the 80s and 90s. Fly to Cuba via Mexico, Canada, or other countries. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
We often hear the term swing voter bandied about during election seasons. They're an elusive bunch that political candidates vie for, traditionally defined as voters who may not be affiliated with a particular party or who, depending on the issues, will vote across party lines. But there's one kind of swing voter our next guest says we don't often consider, and their decisions could make or break a candidate's chances. Ibram Kendi is the director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Institute at American University. He recently wrote about these swing voters for The Atlantic. Ibram, welcome.
Oh, it's great to be on the show.
Well, thanks for being here. Well, let's talk about this for a moment. When we think of swing voters, we tend to think of the kinds of people that I just described. But you're talking about another kind of swing voter. Tell us about them.
Yeah, sure. I think when most Americans and even most political campaigns think of a swing voter, they're thinking of someone who swings from voting Republican to Democrat or vice versa. They're thinking of, for instance, that Obama to Trump voter, that voter who voted for Obama in 2012 and Trump in 2016. This is the prototypical swing voter, and they're almost totally white. But I actually sort of wrote on what I call the other swing voter. And these are voters who are swinging between voting Democrat or not voting at all. And I'm distinguishing them from people who almost never vote. They're a specific group of people who look at Democratic candidates, who don't really even consider Republican candidates, and decide whether they're going to vote for that candidate, or they decide to vote third party. And this group of other swing voters are predominantly young people and even people of color, and especially young people of color. And they swung the 2016 election as much as these white swing voters who had voted for Obama and then Trump.
Let's talk about their significance. How big is this contingent? I mean, is it enough to tilt the election towards one side or another as we enter 2020, especially when you consider the makeup of the Electoral College?
Well, I think if you look, for instance, at the prototypical Obama to Trump voter, and many political analysts have talked about that they helped swing the 2016 election in favor of Trump, that was about 6 million voters. But 4.4 million Obama voters did not vote in 2016, and an additional 2.3 million Obama voters voted third party, which amounts to about 6.7 million voters, which actually are more than the number of people who voted for Obama and then Trump.
You focus in your article on the Democratic version of the swing voter. Does the same category of voter exist on the Republican side?
I think so. And so, in other words, you have people who consider the Republican candidate, and if they don't like the Republican candidate, they don't vote. And so they swing between voting Republican or not voting at all. And this is a sizable number of Americans, too. And just as it's critical for Republicans to focus on those swing voters, it's critical for Democrats to focus on the people who swing from voting Democrat to not voting at all.
I want to talk more about what that looks like, but I want to ask you about something else. You say that the Democrats have to combat the GOP voter depression and suppression. That is, choosing a candidate those swing voters can get excited about and preventing or rolling back voter suppression. From your view, is one of those more important than the other? Is it enough to just do one?
I think you have to do all of the above. And so when we look at, for instance, the prototypical other swing voter, again, the voter who's swinging from voting Democrat to not voting at all, even third party, these are typically young Black voters. And then when we look at, for instance, who the Russians primarily targeted with trolling in the 2016 election, it was young Black voters. When you look at who is most subjected to voter suppression policies, it's typically young voters of color. And so what happens is if you are a young voter of color and you're not excited about the Democratic candidate, it makes it that much harder for you to vote for them if you also have to overcome voter suppression and trolling on social media.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you bring up the Russian disinformation campaign. Even though we reported on their targeting of Black voters in particular, that seems to be something that we're not really focused on, that potentially foreign actors actually see exactly what you're talking about.
Oh, without question. I mean, they see these young Black voters as swing voters, and they recognize by their not voting or by their voting third party, they can swing elections. And they recognize that these young Black voters may not be excited about a moderate candidate that has a difficult racial record, and they can then expose and manipulate them into not voting by information or even disinformation about that particular candidate. And that's what happened in 2016.
Let's talk a little bit about the debate tonight. What would it look like in practice for the candidates to center these swing voters?
Well, when you look at these young Black voters or even young voters or even voters of color, you're talking about people who specifically overwhelmingly support, for instance, $12 minimum wage. You're talking about people who actually in 2016, young Black voters, their two major sort of issues that they thought were that the country should be talking or be taking seriously were police brutality and racism. So you're talking about people who are very concerned about what the Democratic candidate is going to do to combat police brutality and racism. You're talking about people who generally support aggressive action against climate change. You're talking about people who generally have progressive ideas and want progressive policies.
Which of the candidates from review has done the best job on this?
Well, I mean, the recent poll that came out, for instance, that sort of assessed Black voters and what candidate they were most likely to be supporting. Of course, it was widely reported how, of course, Joe Biden was doing extremely well with every segment of Black voters by large margins, except young Black voters. That was the only sort of group of voters who he was behind in by double digits to Bernie Sanders. And so I think just like in the 2016 campaign, in which young Black voters were supportive of Bernie Sanders, they seem to be very supportive of him as well. And again, these are swing voters, right? And so if they really like the candidate, they're more likely to vote than an older Black voter who's more of a regular voter and is going to vote no matter the candidate.
I want to ask you about the importance placed on one demographic, specifically suburban white women. A lot of political analysts and pundits and pollsters, especially in 2018, have talked about the important role white women suburban voters played in the Democratic victories. But there is definitely history here. It's easy to centralize those voices, which often sometimes marginalizes the people that we're talking about, these young Black swing voters. Do you see this as a damaging tactic? Is there a possible way for candidates to speak to them both?
I think there is a way for candidates to speak to them both. And I think part of my essay in The Atlantic was not only to get people to recognize the importance of these other swing voters, but also to think through why they are not recognized as important. Why are we constantly trying to standardize the white voter in the body politic? And what I mean by standardize, value them more than other voters. And it just so happens Americans have always done that. From the beginning of our republic, Americans have been standardizing and valuing white voters more than other groups, as opposed to seeking ways to value all voters equally, not only because we're committed to equity, but that's actually the way in which Democrats win.
The argument may be, though, that by focusing and centering those young swing voters that we're talking about, you might isolate the white vote. I'm just guessing that's the fear.
Well, actually, I'm working on a follow-up essay to this, to the first essay on the other swing voter. And I was studying some data that looked at those Obama to Trump voters who then voted Democrat in the 2018 midterm election. And it found that these voters, again, and they were almost totally white, these white swing voters who voted for Obama, then Trump, then Democrat in 2018, were overwhelmingly in support of Medicare for All. They were overwhelmingly in opposition to the Trump administration leaving the Paris Climate Agreement. They were overwhelmingly in support of a $12 minimum wage. They were overwhelmingly in support of a millionaire's tax. And ironically, their sort of rates of support or opposition to those policies were very similar to the support or opposition of other swing voters, right? And so you're talking about liberal and young white voters who swung for Trump that are actually very winnable for Democrats by pushing forth policies and initiatives that will also win other swing voters.
That's Ibram Kendi. He's director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Institute at American University. He's the author of the book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. Ibram, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
There's increasing pressure on Iran today as Britain, France, and Germany triggered the dispute mechanism in the nuclear agreement. Now, they say it's because of Iran's new violations of that agreement. Iran says it's been stepping away from the accord in response to President Trump pulling completely out of the deal and imposing sanctions, even though at that time Iran was abiding by the deal. President Trump imposed more sanctions last Friday following the Iranian attacks on military bases in Iraq that housed U.S. troops. And there are layers of sanctions on Iran. So to get to a sense of the scale and their impact on Iranians, we want to bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, on Friday, President Trump said in a statement, this order will have a major impact on the Iranian economy. What are the newest sanctions and just what shape is that economy in?
It is very hard to keep track of sanctions on Iran, what's been pulled off after the deal, what's been put back on. But the new sanctions that President Trump announced on Friday through Treasury Secretary Mnuchin target construction in Iran, manufacturing, textiles, and mining. And then they also sanctioned 8 top officials who were thought to be involved in Iran's strike on military bases in Iran, in Iraq, that housed U.S. troops. But the sanctions, the monetary sanctions, are imposed on anyone who owns, operates, trades with, or helps any businesses in the sectors of construction, manufacturing, textile, and mining. When you think about that, that's quite a lot of society.
Yeah. Well, and so how is Iranian society? What's been the impact of the sanctions?
Well, so there have been some version of sanctions since 1979, since the revolution. But really, in 2013, when America got involved in the Iran deal, the way they put pressure on Iran is they took them off this SWIFT system. That's the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Transfers. It's the way money gets traded around the world. So if a carpet store in New York buys Iranian carpets, they pay through an international bank transfer system. Iran was removed from that. And basically, that acted like a sanction on everything, because you didn't have to subject food or medicine to sanctions. People couldn't buy things from overseas. And Iran's response to that was to build a resistance economy where they aggressively invested in domestic production of a lot of these things. But you can't reinvent everything that you import. So it has had a very, very negative effect on Iran's economy since 2013.
And we should say many Republicans are saying that the Democrats handed over billions of dollars, gave all of this money to Iran. They didn't.
It was
money that it was Iranian
seized.
Assets.
It was frozen, yes.
It had been seized and frozen and released when the nuclear deal was struck. But the other people question whether or not, you know, this government really pays attention to the sanctions. They do.
Yeah. I mean, look, at some point, every country has to because, you know, one of the things Iran does, for instance, is subsidizes gasoline. And it is a way to keep a rest of population satisfied when you have cheap food or cheap gasoline. That half of the subsidy on gas has gone away. Fuel prices are up 200%. And Iran's in this weird situation in that it's got a shrinking economy and massive inflation because it's money. Money is devalued. Those are the two worst things that can happen in an economy. So as much tight control as the Iranian regime has over society, the lack of prosperity and financial stress, no matter where it is in the world, causes people to protest. And you're starting to see that happening again in Iran. You started to see it before the recent attacks as well.
And we should say these EU countries that triggered this dispute mechanism say it's not to walk away from Iran. It's
right.
Trying to find a solution. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thank you.
Thanks, Robert.
All of our worlds were shaken this week when 176 people were killed on that Ukrainian International Airlines flight, shot down shortly after takeoff in Iran by a missile strike that was a mistake. Devastating for friends and family, chilling for nervous flyers already haunted by plane crashes, like one a decade ago in Libya, in which just one young Dutch boy survived. That story stayed with author Anne Napolitano. She wondered, how strong is the human spirit? How much do we count on people like that little boy to demonstrate that for us, to live? It inspired her to write a fictionalized version of a crash with a 12-year-old boy named Eddie who loses his parents and a beloved brother on a crash of a flight to L.A., and as the only survivor, he gains the beautiful and burdensome hopes and dreams of the families of those who died. Anne weaves together those two narratives, survivor Edward's struggle to figure out, why me? And back in time, those doomed passengers as they fly toward their fate, a war vet, a young woman who finds out on the flight she's pregnant. Dear Edward is getting early raves. Author Anne Napolitano joins us from New York. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Take us back. What was that terrible crash that so obsessed you?
It was in 2010. It was a flight from South Africa bound for London, and it crashed in Libya. And there was only one survivor. It was a 9-year-old Dutch boy named Ruben van Assau. And basically his seat was found about a half mile away from the rest of the wreckage, and he was still buckled in, and he had a punctured lung and a broken leg, but he was otherwise fine. Mm. And his brother and his parents had been on the flight, and everyone else had died immediately. Mm. And I could not read enough about this story. I had two little boys at the time, a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old, and there was a photo of Ruben in the hospital, and he was so beautiful and broken and yet alive and okay that I felt like I needed to make a world in which he could walk forward and have a life in which something like that, if it had happened to one of my boys, that I could imagine a future for them.
Well, that's what you say in the afterword, that it was also inspired by thinking of your own two boys. And, you know, we think of family and what would this be like? But a lot of people can't go toward that thought. You know, they want to stay as far away from it as possible. Here you spend years making yourself think, what would this be like? What was that like?
I think it's a preoccupation with like what your worst nightmare would be and then finding a way to make it okay. So it was trying to create a world that was so imbued with kindness that there was a way for this boy to find a way forward.
Mm-hmm. And we don't want to give away too many of the plot twists, but let's just give a little of the narrative. He's a New York City kid, homeschooled by his dad along with his brother Jordan, who he adores, his older, slightly cooler brother. Plays the piano, shy. Suddenly he's in a hospital bed and people are asking him, how are you doing? And you write, Edward is unable to answer any of these questions. He can't consider how he's feeling. That door is far too dangerous to open. Did you do research? Because after reading your book, I did, you know, Google around, and there are articles about sole survivors. There's one, George Lamson Jr. in 1985, the only one to survive a crash that killed 71 in Reno, Nevada. Did you research what survivors go through?
Yes. I'm a nervous flyer. I never thought that I would write a book about a plane crash. So I had to do an extensive amount of research. I spoke to a pilot. I did a lot of reading. I read National Transportation Safety Board transcripts, which is the national organization that after every major tragedy, they publish a document that says basically what the issue was, what went wrong. I read and talked to as many people as I could because I was coming from a place of very little knowledge. And also, I wanted it to feel true. I didn't want to sensationalize the crash. I wanted it to have the weight that it actually has in the people's lives who lose someone and the people who are on the plane themselves.
You take us through this terrible cascade of mistakes that leads to the crash. But back to Eddie. Eddie becomes Edward. It's as if almost Eddie has died with his whole family. He's adopted by his aunt and uncle, who have their own pain. His aunt, of course, lost her sister, Eddie's mother. But she's also been trying to have children, not successfully. His uncle becomes obsessed with researching the crash. Along the way, when they're first trying to keep him away from the public that's so fascinated with him, he sort of gets treated a little bit like a hotel guest. Did you research that as well, that how people don't know how, people don't know what to do?
Well, I did read a lot about soul survivors, but more it was coming from a place of even if your spouse dies and you enter a room, people do not know what to say to you. And this was magnified times a million. And he was a child as well, so the adults couldn't even begin to understand where he might be. And so they're so careful around him. And that leaves the importance of there's a girl who lives next door named Shay, who's his age. And he ends up sleeping on her floor because he needs to be by another kid because he misses his brother so much. And he also because she treats him like a normal person because she's a child herself.
At one point, he just can't go to a hearing in Washington, D.C. about the plane crash. And she says, well, no one there can hurt you. I mean, you already lost everything, right? You know, like,
she speaks the truth to him, whereas the grown-ups are more withholding.
He also has, in addition to the guilt, and we'll talk about that, he has PTSD when he's forced to go to gym class and play basketball. People bumping into him, it's like a plane crash all over again. I mean, he has a physical response.
Yes. When he's in the hospital after the crash, one of the doctors says to the aunt and uncle that the effects could last for years and it could affect his smell, his balance, his understanding of the world around him. You just don't know when the symptoms were going to hit and how they were going to hit. And really, he's 12 when the plane crashes. And when the book ends, he's 18. And it takes that long of all these tiny steps, both forward and backward, of him trying to make his way to a world where he feels connected again and where he's able to love again and able to accept love. Because it's not a quick process. No. I mean, it just wouldn't be.
It's years. I mean, we watch him grow taller and taller and taller, and he's still wrestling with this. You know, just another moment with Shay, because she's so blunt. She says to, now, Edward, he shouldn't worry about taking another flight because he's already crashed, and it's statistically impossible for him to crash twice. And you write, Edward barely registers what she said. He's been sucker-punched in that moment by memories of his brother. And he knows he has to ride the memories out. The only way out of it is through it. So he sees Jordan beside him on the plane, knows that the smallest, truest reason he will never fly again is that the last airplane seat he ever sits in has to be the one beside his brother. That, you know, brings us to this guilt he feels, this, like, why me? Obviously another consequence of, you know, being a survivor.
Yeah, and he's the younger brother, too. So, of course, as his therapist points out to him, his brother was 15 and he was 12. And 15-year-olds have more developed personality than 12-year-olds do. And so Eddie, along with missing his brother with every fiber of his being, also feels that his brother had more to offer than he does. So he has to work through both emotions throughout the book.
And in all the research we did, you probably found the same thing. The one way to get through is to do something for someone else. And we're not going to give it away, but he sure does. But in the meantime, there are a couple sidebars here. People who just want to make him something he's not. He's just a kid. When he leaves the hospital, for instance, there's a mob scene. So many eyes stare at Edward, the scene looks like a Picasso painting. Hundreds of eyeballs, and then a smattering of limbs and hairstyles. He realizes he's famous. You've written that you were fascinated by the social media part of this.
Yes, in 2010, it actually was the first time that social media had become kind of what we understand it to be today. So when that crash happened, the real crash, there were young girls who had posted pages for Ruben with pictures of him and talking about how devastated they were and how they hoped he was okay. It wasn't just the journalists reporting. It was everyone. I mean, I think people were looking for connection. Yeah. And they're looking for meaning, and so they were trying to put that on Edward, which is an inappropriate place to put it since he was a young boy who had just lost everything.
It would be inappropriate to put it on anybody. Nobody can be who the families of the victims want them to be. And you have a great response. I won't say which character tells Eddie this, but at one point someone says, oh, you're nothing special. There's absolutely no reason why you survived this. And it's such a relief.
Yeah, it's a huge gift.
Yeah. How about for you, Anne Napolitano? Did you lose some of your fear of flying?
No, I probably am about the same. I'm still a nervous flyer. I think that I have a greater appreciation for how amazing it is that we can launch these giant buses up into the air and fly where we want to go. I think that is truly awesome. But I also look around at the passengers around me and wonder what their stories are. I feel like I'm aware of connections everywhere I go, and in the air, certainly no exception.
That's so interesting because that's what I did. I just,
time
I met a new character while I was reading your book while flying, I would look around and think to myself, I should look at all these people around me. You know, we're in this together, and let's see them. Anne Napolitano, editor of One Story Magazine, her new book, Dear Edward. It's really quite something. Anne, thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you so much.
More than 36 Democratic lawmakers are demanding that the Trump administration explain why it has not released billions of dollars of congressionally approved disaster relief to Puerto Rico. The group wrote and signed a letter to the administration, which was delivered yesterday. This, as thousands in Puerto Rico are still displaced after a powerful series of earthquakes. NPR's Adrian Florido is in San Juan. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, Tanya.
Thank you for joining us. And you've been on the ground in the most affected areas to the south. What have you seen?
So right now what we're seeing is thousands of people basically living on the streets, sleeping every night on sidewalks or encampments that have sprung up on the sides of roads or on hillsides or in these big sort of open-air shelters that local officials have set up. And the reason there are so many people living outside is because they're afraid. As these aftershocks have continued, people are afraid that their houses might come tumbling to the ground with them inside. And so people are refusing to go back to their homes. Listen to a woman I spoke with at one of these roadside encampments. Her name is Iris Tirado. Here's what she had to say.
Y el día tras día de uno pensando qué pasará, qué irá a hacer de nosotros, cómo nos van a resolver, no sabemos. Pero si te digo también, según te digo todo esto, te digo que aquí no nos ha faltado nada.
What Tirado is saying is that, you know, there's so much uncertainty in people's lives right now. They don't know how they're going to resolve this situation, whether they're going to be able to move back into their homes. Her apartment, for example, was destroyed, and she has no idea what she's going to do. But on the other hand, she said that at these roadside encampments, they've been getting a lot of help from just everyday citizens, Puerto Ricans from across the island who've been mobilizing to go and take food and toiletries and clothes and sleeping bags and cots to people who've been affected.
The people of Puerto Rico have endured so much in the last few years with hurricanes and now these earthquakes. I can imagine that it's taken such a toll on them. And while there are community organizations and relief groups that are there, can you tell us a little bit more about relief and groups stepping up to provide shelter for these people who are outside?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's not any sort of formal shelter that is currently being provided to speak of. You know, like I said, citizens from across the island have been coming in to provide tents and sleeping bags. These are all things that are being donated. The government has set up these open-air shelters. And in the last couple of days, the army has actually been setting up these large tent cities, five of them across the affected region, and officials are encouraging people to basically move in to these tent cities, an indication, you know, that this situation is not going to be resolved anytime sort of in the immediate term because, again, these aftershocks continue, and there's a lot of inspection and that sort of thing that needs to happen at people's homes before people can move back.
Puerto Rico's Governor Wanda Vazquez last week asked President Trump to approve a federal disaster declaration. That has not happened yet, but this is important. What's the latest?
Yeah, what President Trump did approve was an emergency declaration, which makes some money available for the response to the earthquake. But what a federal disaster declaration would do is make a lot more money available, including money to, for example, put people up in hotels to resolve some of this issue of the shelter that you were just asking me about. Also to, in the longer term, help people repair their homes. But the president hasn't done that yet. FEMA yesterday, I believe, said that that request is apparently still under consideration, and we don't know whether it's going to be approved. But because Puerto Rico's, you know, government is effectively bankrupt, you know, it probably won't really be able to help this region recover unless federal money is made available. It just won't be able to afford it.
Right. I mean, we've been talking so much, too, about earthquake preparedness. We were hearing numbers that 90% of the buildings in Puerto Rico are not earthquake-proof. I can imagine that earthquake readiness is now a part of the political agenda as it hasn't been before.
Yeah, that number, 90-95% of buildings not being sort of earthquake resilient, I think it refers to a comment that the education secretary here made when he was asked about how many of the public schools were up to code, and his response was that something around 95% probably were not. Yes, people here are talking about what it's going to take for homes and public buildings and private buildings to be brought up to code. It's a huge task, in part because, for example, if we're talking about, you know, people's homes, there's an estimate that something like 50 to 55% of the houses in Puerto Rico were built informally without proper title, without the necessary permits. There's a big issue of this sort of informal housing here, and you can probably pretty much be guaranteed that most of those houses are not built up to code. And so it's something that, you know, local officials are going to have to grapple with.
That's NPR's Adrian Florido joining us from San Juan, Puerto Rico. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tanya.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
From the early 20th century through the 1970s, millions of Black Americans left the South for northern and western cities. The Great Migration is now the focus of a new illustrated history.
I think that a book with illustrations is more approachable to a wider audience, and I wanted to make sure this got into the hands of as many people as possible.
That's next time on Here and Now.